This is Penn Sunday School, and to our listening ears, all nature sings, and round us spins the music of the sea.
Here we go.
Brothers, sisters, and siblings, welcome to Penn Sunday School, starring Penn Jillette. My name is Michael Godot. Penn, Matt, Reddy, Rich, and I are broadcasting from our separate homes here in Las Vegas. On this week's show, we'll be hitting some of our viewer mail. We'll get Matt to give us some foolish recaps, and Reddy is still suffering from COVID. But it's only been 15 minutes since we finished the last podcast, so no surprise there. Here he is preaching love, Mr. Penn Jillette.
Yeah, preaching the love is what we are doing. Yeah, here we are in our separate homes because we are stupid and aren't following the science in the opposite direction. So I believe we would be safe to be together, but we're pretending we're not. Is that what's going on?
Yep.
Yes. That's a quick recap. Yeah.
Boy, it's hard to know what to do with this COVID stuff. I have two teenagers that I'm responsible for. And, you know, they want to go out with a friend to sushi. And how far apart are the booths? And they're going to go to an arcade. Are they going to be wearing masks? And then they say, after I go through all this stuff, they go, oh, by the way, at school, no one enforces the mask thing. And children just wear them drooped down around their chin. We go, okay. All right. And, you know, they want to go over a friend's house, and we call the parents, and they go, yeah, you know, we only wear a mask when we're forced to out in public.
Oh. Fantastic. Fantastic. That's great.
But, you know, you want your children to have some sort of social life, because we saw very clearly how well they do when they don't.
Yeah, exactly. It's so hard. And then they don't face the same health repercussions that we do. And it's so hard to figure out.
Yeah. I think overall, this pandemic is a bad thing.
Overall, it's been a little rough. Let's talk about it in another way. How are you supposed to treat someone who says the earth is flat? How do you have a general conversation with that? Let's pretend we're not talking actually about COVID and masks. Let's pretend we're talking about flat earth, because then everybody can get on board. Are we supposed to be kind and patient with people who make those types of crazy claims? How? I don't know what I'm supposed to do.
Well, there's a little difference in that, Godot, because it's like, I believe the world is flat, and I'm going to inject you with smallpox at the same time. I just saw the list. I was reading the news, and you know, everybody seems to believe that Omicron being more mild than the previous, you know, Delta, means that the virus is evolving to be milder, and that that's what viruses do. By the way, that's not what viruses do. That's what the flu did. Smallpox, Ebola, AIDS, they didn't go that way.
Right.
They went the other way. Because there are two conflicting evolutionary pressures. Obviously, if your host lives longer, more of that spreads. But also, the bigger the viral load, the better that is for the virus too. So there's conflicting evolutionary pressure. It's not necessarily going to get milder. We'd like it to be, and it could be.
I think that it causes that much confusion is what makes Omicron my favorite. I think that's really... This has been my favorite variant, and it's been my favorite wave by a long shot.
Yeah.
It's definitely the cutest name.
And all we got to do is get to Omega, and we're done, right?
Yeah. Once we run out of those letters, then we can't have any more variants.
Right, yeah.
It knows about
the alphabet. It'd be like hurricanes. Maybe we'll start with Alfred.
Well, that's why.
Variant Alfred.
I don't know if there's any science behind it, but it certainly seemed like original COVID-19 and Delta were like, let's leave them alone while they're eating and drinking. Let's they take the mask off. We will not get them infected while they eat and drink. And then Omicron was like, this is silly. It's right there. The nose and mouth are right there. Like, I can get in there.
It also is so weird that eating and drinking is not magic.
I know.
Take the mask off when you're eating or drinking. It's like saying, you know, take your seatbelt off whenever you see a McDonald's sign.
Well, you know, one of the pieces of advice that's floating around now in the pile of things floating around was if you're going on a plane trip, don't eat when everybody else is eating.
Right.
Just wait.
I always follow that.
Right. That's a good one.
I don't eat on airplanes because there's just no upside to that.
Yeah.
Even before the coronavirus, it's bad food that you eat because you're nervous and you get fat.
Yeah. I wait till everyone is done eating, then I pull out my oil and vinegary sub from a sub shop.
Yeah.
And just let that permeate throughout the aisle.
The fried fish po' boy.
I like to bring kimchi with me on the airplane.
Yeah. That's healthy.
It's healthy.
Until somebody whacks you in the side of the head.
That probably, the odor on that probably kills coronavirus, yeah? Just inhaling that?
I would think nothing can live around kimchi. And we have our homemade kimchi.
Right.
Delicious.
You know, so we rot our own cabbage. And when I say we, I don't do any of the work, just so you know. But I am very good at leaving the kimchi out to rot.
Yes.
So it gets stronger. So by the time I get to the kimchi, no one else, I think, in the world can eat it. I mean, even North Koreans could not eat this kimchi that I eat. I love it. And once again, I'm very happy to say, since the beginning of the year, I've been losing weight at a very good rate. I'm back on that groove. Because my weight had snuck up over a year. Over a year, it snuck up badly. So I'm taking it down again. And kimchi is my friend in that, you know? If you decide every time I'm hungry, I'm going to eat kimchi, you're really safe.
Yeah. It's not long before you go, hey, I'm not that hungry.
I was going to say, it's a fine middle finger to the craving part of your brain.
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, you think you're hungry? Here's some kimchi. Oh, all right. You got me again, Ben. You got me good.
I have to give kudos to your wife for making kimchi that tastes legit, even though there's no animal products in it.
Yeah.
It's really good.
You, you've had it, right? My kimchi. It's really good.
Great.
And it gets stronger. It stays safe, right, everybody? You can eat kimchi anytime after. It's so rotten that it's not dangerous.
I don't know.
I leave the medical advice to Godot.
Yeah, and I don't know the kimchi specifics. But you should double your dosage. That's what I
think. I believe the fermentation was created in order to make it safe. Is that right?
Yes.
But there's no telling if it can't go past that or something else can't grow in it. We just don't know.
Oh, there is telling. Someone knows this.
Yes.
We know as much about kimchi as we do about Omicron. There's a lot of debate as to how to handle this kimchi thing properly.
But the weird thing is that kimchi is only dangerous when you're eating and drinking.
And we're 20 years out from knowing the truth about kimchi.
Yeah. I got to tell you, there's a lot of sadness in the world, losing Louis Anderson and Meatloaf. I never met Meatloaf. Anybody here knew Meatloaf?
No.
I know Meatloaf liked jugglers. Meatloaf,
yeah, we had jugglers. A chance. I spoke to someone on his crew for a while. He had a show, and I was asked if I would run across stage juggling, I think it was machetes once.
Yeah.
And Jennifer
Jen
got that job.
That job. Jen right. got that gig.
Yeah.
Jen Zabo. Sabo. Yeah. Jen
I was called on that gig as well. So
that's what's fun about living in Vegas is that entertainers will spend at least some portion of their career here. And so he had that storyteller's show that he was doing at the Planet Hollywood, two different runs or whatever. People said that was a great show, and anyone who got to work on that said that he was really great to work with. I thought what was interesting about his death was that, like, the amount of people that wanted me to hate him in death just popped up out of nowhere. So,
what do you mean?
Well, you know, like, I think there's a difference between people like Eric Clapton, who, like, put out an album to be like, let's stop wearing masks and who cares about this coronavirus, versus people who just have opinions that are a little, you know, I guess he was on the record for being upset about Australia's laws and not being able to go to Australia and make money on his gigs. And so they're like, he was anti-vax and he might have died of COVID. Good. And I'm like, I don't know if we want to know everyone's opinions about stuff if they're not trying to take a point of leadership on it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. You know, my family at dinner the other night started the discussion. If you could go back in time, would you kill Hitler?
Ah, classic dinner conversation.
I said, everybody, of course, jumped in with yes. And I said, no, I would not. And they said, why? And I said, well, in this scenario, you have no trial. In this scenario, you're also pro-death penalty, which I am against for everybody. And boy, that was not a popular position at the dinner table.
Yeah.
Did you say we'd go back and sit on Hitler? Just sit on his back so he couldn't do any of those things?
Well, I said, wouldn't you be better off going back in time and buying Microsoft stock?
Yeah.
Then you give that money as reparations to all the people who wanted you to kill Hitler.
Maybe. Maybe if you just bought some of his art.
Yeah.
You know, if you just went in and went, oh my gosh, you're an amazing painter. Maybe that would have changed the course of the world.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, you could have you know, there's probably other things you could have done to distract him.
Yeah.
Sent in Ava Braun a little earlier.
Or go back with Omicron, breathe in his face so he couldn't give the speeches.
Yeah.
But that's, I mean, like Meatloaf and I probably didn't agree on a lot of things. I don't hold a big enough place in my heart for him that I would need to, like, retroactively be filled with hate about it as he is dead.
Yeah, you know, that's the problem. You know, you go to In-N-Out Burger, and you look at the bottom of their cups, which incidentally is always good comedy because you automatically pour your drink on the person next to you. You look at the bottom of their cups and it has, you know, scripture. Isn't it John 3:16?
3:16, yeah.
So you say, I'm going to boycott In-N-Out Burger. And then when you fly Alaska Airlines, they have a little thing about thanking God on their tray when they serve you your meal on the airplane. And you go, oh, I got to boycott Alaska Airlines. And then you look at, you know, Chick-fil-A and you say, well, you know, they do all this bad stuff with anti-gay things and Hobby Lobby. And, yeah. But I really think if you start digging about every little thing, don't you end up boycotting everything?
Oh, yeah. That's why I was laughing. They're like, oh, if you drink, you know, you don't drink beer, but someone's... So you drink a beer and they're like, oh, you know, the CEO is a real asshole. You know, like, if I was in a room and there's a bunch of old white dudes who are CEOs, I wouldn't think, I better get along with all these guys. You know, like, I think I probably feel very differently and vote differently than the people I'm talking to in this room. It gets very hard to figure out. And then also, like, when they're going to gain customers for the same reason you're going to boycott it, then how are we doing this? You know, like... Then they're not going anywhere. Yeah.
Because obviously you don't want to make those people think that their position is the position everybody has. And the way to do that is with economic pressure. It's a very difficult decision. You know?
Well, that's right. I mean, that's the thing. It's like, and so with Meatloaf, I can't throw out his records because I don't own them. And I can't, like, it's like, I can't spend time hating something that didn't occupy a space. I was like, all right, I won't go to that side of the dance floor at the next wedding I'm at. Is the most I could protest Meatloaf's death.
Yeah, is that a popular song at weddings?
Yeah, they do Let Me Sleep On It, Will You Love Me Forever? You know, you do the whole Both Sides of the Dance Floor. Paradise by the Dashboard Lights.
They do Both Sides of the Dance Floor in that
You get weddings? The guys on one side and the girls on the other.
No wonder I don't go to weddings.
Yeah, you've really been missing out. It's one of the few songs where everyone knows what to do. You know?
Yeah, that and the chicken.
So thing. Everybody yells. It's like they line up the men and the women, and then one yells, I want to fuck you, and the other say, I don't want to fuck you.
Yeah. That. But in, you know, different languages, depending on which wedding you're at. Yeah. And then you slowly move closer, then everybody dances with each other, and we're all happy at the end.
Oh. There you go. Yeah. There's all this part of the culture I just don't understand. Because I've never gone to weddings. I've
been boycotting weddings.
Yeah.
I have been. I don't like them.
Yeah. Well, I can explain it to you.
Please.
He built his career making songs that DJs could go to the bathroom to. And that's why they're popular.
Yeah, and I guess like even Bat Out of Hell was like this derivative. Like someone found a thing where he was saying, "I figured Springsteen with this shameless epic rock and roll, I can do that too." And so it was almost like making fun of Springsteen was Bat Out of Hell, and I'm supposed to hate him for that as a big Springsteen person. And I was like, he's not even close to the first musician to think, "Oh, if Springsteen can do it, I can do it."
Well, I'll tell you,
isn't that Springsteen's message?
Exactly.
when Bat Out of Hell came out, and yeah. I heard it for the first time, and I didn't care for it, and I said, "Bruce, this is your fault." But also, Roy Bittan played on it, and Mighty Max Weinberg.
Oh, right. Yeah.
They both play on Bat Out of Hell.
Yeah.
But I mean, Springsteen was, I mean, incredibly bombastic and not in any way tasteful or attenuated, but I just bought into the Springsteen thing and didn't buy into, you know, Jim Steinman was Teller's roommate at college.
Really?
So we had a connection with Bat Out of Hell, yeah.
Oh.
They went to Amherst College together.
I mean, I think he's a very unique career, and he's a very unique performer. And
Meatloaf?
Yeah. And
you know, I remember something else from Rolling Stone that probably wasn't true, that I don't really remember. There was an interview with Meatloaf that I thought he was really clever. Somebody said to him, it was recorded, "How does a fat, sweaty, ugly pig like you get women?" And he said, "By not saying things to people like fat, ugly, sweaty pig."
And he's also one of those people whose name is he didn't need a nickname. His real name was Marvin Lee Adday.
Mm-hmm.
That's a fine name. That is a fine rock and roll name.
Mm-hmm, it is.
Yeah.
But you know the worst case of that. The worst case of somebody having a different name who didn't need it is Vanilla Ice.
Right.
Rob Van Winkle.
Yeah.
How could you better than Rob Van Winkle?
Right. Engelbert Humperdinck.
Well, that wasn't his real name.
No, no, it wasn't. Was it? I thought it was Jerry Dorsey.
Yeah, that's what I said. It's not his real name.
Yeah.
Jerry Dorsey's not a better name than Engelbert Humperdinck. You know why he had the name Engelbert Humperdinck? Do you know that?
I don't.
Engelbert Humperdinck is actually a composer. A composer from, I think, the 19th century.
Yeah.
And they had the same manager. Tom Jones and Engelbert Humperdinck had the same manager. And the manager believed very strongly in memorable names. So he gave Tom Jones, who I forgot his real name, Tom Jones, the name Tom Jones, of course, the famous novel. And then he went to Engelbert Humperdinck, Jerry, and said, "We'll give you the name of the composer," which I always thought that Jerry would have said, "How come I got Engelbert Humperdinck?"
Be Tom Jones.
Was there like a straw that I forgot to grab?
Yeah, that.
Where did
you pick one name out of the bag here?
Someone call a coin flip. I missed it. I don't know where. I'd like to redraft, please.
Sir Thomas John Woodward.
Sir Thomas John. His first name really is Tom?
That's Tom Jones, yeah.
Oh.
And John.
That's right. Woodward, you have a hard time being a big, sexy rocker with Woodward. That's a good call.
Mm-hmm. Although there was that great folk duo, Woodward and Bernstein.
Yeah. Sang a lot in the Nixon era, didn't they?
Yeah.
A
lot of
Jerry stuff. Dorsey, Engelbert Humperdinck. Yeah, Meatloaf, and he was also a Broadway-trained singer, right?
Think so. My favorite clip, if you want to treat yourself, is, who is that girl in American Idol? I'm blanking on her name. They brought a Meatloaf for a duet.
Kelly Clarkson?
No, it wasn't Kelly Clarkson. It was,
Now we've named everybody we can think of on American Idol. Is that right?
I got it first.
Was it Clay Aiken?
Nah, shoot.
Oh.
Catherine McPhee.
Yes, Catherine McPhee. And, he performed his usual duet intensity. He's, you know, sweating and spitting and everything. And she was not ready for the full Meatloaf experience. And it is really funny to watch on American Idol.
Yeah, Meatloaf did not attenuate at all, did he?
No.
He went 100%. Yeah. They were saying, they interviewed whatever her name is, Carla, who worked with them. And she said when they would tour, Paradise by the Dashboard Light would end up going over 20 minutes.
Yeah. That's, this is why I don't want to take him seriously and hold him accountable for like how he voted or something. Like this is just, he was a production and it was fine to take him at a distance.
Speaking of how you voted, Clay Aiken is running for senator of North Carolina. Again.
Yeah.
And I did something kind of crazy. I donated money to his campaign.
Really?
Nah.
Yeah. I sent him a small amount. I have headroom. I can
for now. Wait till you get all the emails. It's just going to keep coming. You're just going to keep being asked to chip in. It's urgent.
Yeah.
And
today's the day.
We need 100 more people today.
Today.
I wrote to Clay some ideas that I think are kind of valid. You know, Clay Aiken and I, were we to have met outside of Celebrity Apprentice, I believe would have, if not been great friends, certainly would have gotten along wonderfully. You know, Clay is a sweet, smart, empathetic, gentle person. And
taller than you think.
Yeah, much taller than you think.
Yeah.
And we agree on many, many things. Now, he's religious. I'm not. He's certainly more physically liberal than I was. But we would have gotten along very, very well. We were on this show with Donald Trump where, in order to make the show interesting, we were put up against each other and had conflict with each other in order for the show to be good, right?
Poked with sticks, and, right? Put in cages and poked with sticks.
Yeah, orchestrated by Trump. And it was very hard. I mean, I realize this is not a profound thing to say, but it was very hard to not make that a microcosm for how Trump helped rip this country apart. You know, I mean, Rush Limbaugh certainly started it. He taught people to be aggrieved. I mean, before Rush Limbaugh, if you lost a football game, you went, "Oh, damn, my team lost." And after Rush Limbaugh, you went, "The refs were cheating."
It's rigged.
You know, rigged. Yeah, everything's rigged. And it's really hard not to see that parallel. After all these years, what's it been, almost 10 years, I suppose, from Celebrity Apprentice, it's very hard not to take all the animosity that Clay exhibited toward me and move that directly to Trump as his cause, you know. Because Trump loves conflict. And, you know, I don't. I really think maybe it's as I've gotten older, but I do not like conflict. I don't enjoy it. But I don't know if going up against Meatloaf after he's dead, I mean, I think you want to make your case that masks are important and people should be vaccinated and we should be careful. But I think you can make that point without hating someone who sang Paradise by the Dashboard Light.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can make all those points and not back down on those points and still not be infused with hatred.
Right.
I think. But boy, you know, all these people that aren't that much older than us, or in the case of Saget, younger than me.
Right.
A friend of mine called me from Vermont. Actually, I called him. Doesn't matter, I guess. And we were chatting as I drove to work. He said he's realized he's going to die. And I said to him, "Really?" And he said, "Yeah. With Saget and Louis and Meatloaf, I'm going to die." And I said, "Do you really believe that?" You know, because I read a lot of Zen Buddhist stuff. And there's a lot of stuff about really deeply accepting the fact that you're going to die and really meditating on your death and really, really feeling it that you're going to die. And I said all that to him, and I said, do you feel it? And he said, no, I don't feel it. He said, intellectually, I know I'm going to die. I don't feel it emotionally. And I can't even emotionally feel that Bob Saget is going to die and has died. How do you feel about that, Godot? Do you feel like you're going to die?
No, not a chance. I mean, I can talk, you know, in my head, talk to myself about it and say that this is happening. And I have no sense of the horror. I don't think horror is the right word. Every now and then I get a glimpse. I get a moment where I feel like this is natural and going to happen. But that's very rare.
Ready, Rich. Do you feel you're going to die?
There's a non-zero chance I will be dead by the time this show posts.
Do you feel that?
I did this morning.
Matt Donnelly.
I'm the kind of person, like, my brain gets a little lost. Like, I basically have spoken at all your funerals like 100 times in my head. You've all spoken at my funeral 100 times in my head. I kind of think about my kids growing up with one family member or you know, whatever, all the time. I kind of, my natural inclination on daydreaming is to think about absolute tragedy, and unless I stop myself from doing it.
But that's different. Thinking of the tragedy is different than really accepting the fact that you will be dead.
Yeah, no. I mean, only when, like, you know, if I measure my blood pressure and it's up real high, I spend a couple of hours really self-loathing and feeling like I'm going to be a dead person. But
that's still very, very different.
Yeah.
That's very different because feeling guilt about lifestyle choices, feeling in danger are very different than what I'm talking about.
No. I would say,
accepting the fact that there will be a time that you will no longer exist.
No, is the answer then.
It's really hard. It's really hard.
Yeah.
You know, to do that real Buddhist thing of accepting the fact that life is temporary and you'll be gone.
There are parts of it that are, you know, impossible to imagine. I have an autistic son. I don't know. What does that leave him with if I'm dead? You know, that's the most horrifying thing to me. Of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Trying to solve those problems. How am I going to make sure that he has enough money? You know, obviously washing dishes at Panera is not going to make him enough money to live. You know, that's the scary. Maybe that's not what you're talking about, but that's the scariest part for me.
Yeah, that's really, really deeply not what I'm talking about.
No, I do know that.
Those are worries with compassion and empathy, Godot. That's the easy stuff to worry about.
No, it absolutely is.
I don't mean easy in terms of not bothersome. I mean easy in terms of
imagining.
Know where to go with that kind of stuff. The imagination. But the imagination, imagining the lack of imagination is very difficult.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Just
the closest I can come to... to feeling it is thinking about, well, I wasn't here before. You know what I mean? And that's the only part of it that makes the most sense to me. I said, well, I wasn't around when Mark Twain was here, and I think it's going to go back to that. I'm not going to be here, and Mark Twain's not going to be here either. So I understand that very clearly, and I feel that and have a sense of that.
Now, maybe this is off subject a little bit, but did you know that Mark Twain's real name was Samuel Clemens?
I heard Samuel Clemens means 2 feet thick.
Here's a lovely thought from the chat.
Mm-hmm.
What annoys me most about the thoughts of death is realizing you're wasting the little time you have on it.
Huh?
Yeah.
That's from Gubbier.
Thanks, Gubbier.
Thanks, Gubbier. We like profound thoughts from silly names.
Thank you, Gavya.
Are you trying to do an English thing there?
Right?
Sorry, forgive me. You were successfully doing a beautiful English thing there. So what else is going on, guys? Did you see this thing in the Times? Man, did I love it. There's an article in the Times. It's a fiction. They're calling it fiction. It's called Curiosity is Not a Good Reason to Get Married. and it's called A Diary in Alphabetical Order, A to C, by Sheila Hetty. Hetty? H-E-T-I. How do you say H-E-T-I?
Hetty?
Hetty?
I would go Hetty.
Sheila like it. Hetty. Sheila Hetty is a genius, okay? I want to read this to you. I'm going to read the intro to this because it'll blow your mind. A little more than 10 years ago, I began looking back at the diaries I had kept over the previous decade. I wondered if I'd changed. So I loaded all 500,000 words of my journals into Excel to order the sentences alphabetically. Perhaps this would help me identify patterns and repetitions. How many times had I written, "I hate him," for example? With the sentences untethered from narrative, I started to see the self in a new way, as something quite solid, anchored by shockingly few characteristic preoccupations. As I returned to the project over the years, it grew into something more novelistic. I blurred the characters and cut thousands of sentences to introduce some rhythm and beauty. When the Times asked me for a work of fiction that could be serialized, I thought of these diaries. The self's report on itself is surely a great fiction. What is more fundamental a mode of serialization than the alphabet? After some editing, here's the result. This is part one of a 10-part series. You can subscribe to the 10-part series. How is that for an idea? Is that a brilliant, brilliant idea?
Well, like, I'd be curious, like, if I could run my emails through this, like, I'd be like almost embarrassed. Like, that's crazy.
And for those of us who keep journals, which is to say me and most 16-year-old girls and no one else.
Hetty.
I've got 35 years of journals where I write 500 to 1,000 words a day. So I've got almost her entire diary I've got in a year and a half. I've got about 500,000 words every year and a half, and I've got 35 years of that. And I love constrained artwork. You know, we all know how much I love Eunoia.
Mm-hmm.
Which is the book by Christian Bach, where he writes each chapter using only one vowel. So there's A, right. There's E, there's I, there's O, there's U, and there's sometimes Y. And if you have not heard Eunoia or read Eunoia, I cannot recommend stronger that you buy Eunoia, E-U-N-O-I-A, by Christian Bach. B-O-K with a little thing over the O. I think it's, what's the little hat called? What accent is that?
Carone?
I guess so.
Programmers call it carrot?
Carrot, yeah, carrot. Yeah. Carrot over the O. Anyway, it's an amazing book, and you can go online and hear him read parts of it, and it will blow your mind. Constrained poetry kills me. And the idea that she went through and curated her actual diary is so brilliant. She just went to about my favorite white writer just like that. I'm going to read a little bit of this. Remember that every sentence is in alphabetical order, not the words. It's a full sentence in alphabetical order.
Yeah, right.
Actually, he doesn't love you. Actually, he doesn't want you. Actually, he's looking around the world for another girl, and because of who he is, he will find her and be with her. Added in about 4,000 words, bringing it to 56,000. After all, one does have to get back to work. After he left, I lay in bed, hungover, and the sun was shining into my room for the day. After that, I got in a cab and came home. After that, we all walked by the river. Alice Munro's first book appeared when she was 37. All I am ambitious for is to publish this piece. All I ever wanted was to be an adult. All I ever wanted when I was younger was to be a writer, to be able to sit in one place and write things forever and not feel I had to do anything else. All I want is for some more experience with him. All I want is breakfast with my friends to return home for the rest of this bright and beautiful sunny day. All I want is to read books for a year. All my work is so pleasurable these days. All of a sudden, he didn't seem very smart to me. His belligerence wasn't very interesting, or his interest in gossip, or his vanity about being in New York and coming into contact with certain people, or his insistence on seeing me in a certain light. All of a sudden, I feel happy. And that goes on all the way through C. And she has 10 or 9, I don't know which, more installments coming that I presume will take her all the way through the alphabet.
Wow. That's fascinating.
So fucking brilliant.
I mean, just also just to get to that section where you write all I want and then
to have a million
all those different things be all I want. That
really,
alone is.
It's really brilliant. She is. I want to read her other novels now because someone who has that idea and can curate it so beautifully blows my mind. But that's in the New York Times. It's called Curiosity is Not a Good Reason to Get Married, which incidentally is the last line of this. A Diary in Alphabetical Order by Sheila H-E-T-I, Hetty. Sheila Hetty. And I can't recommend it high enough, along with Eunoia by Christian Bach. And I've got a book here of constrained poetry by a real nut who makes Sheila and Christian look like slackers. It's a guy named Anthony Etherin. I've met him. He's in English. Anthony Etherin, E-T-H-E-R-I-N. And the book is called Slate Petals. Now, what do you notice about the name Slate Petals?
Slate?
Rocks and flowers?
D's and T's?
It's a palindrome.
Okay.
He writes anagram palindromes. He wrote all of Moby Dick as a palindrome and then wrote it again as an anagram palindrome of the first palindrome.
Wait, what's an anagram palindrome?
It means he took all the letters from the other palindrome and did it again with just those same letters.
Oof.
He wrote an anagram of the to be or not to be soliloquy using all the same letters. Do you know how long he works on things?
That's insane.
A really, really long time. He also does the Alenodrome. Alenodrome is a new constraint which I devised during the autumn of 2012. After discovering the possibility and potential of palindromes by pairs, in tense, I am Einstein. That means you reverse each two letters and put those together in a palindrome.
Jeez.
He also writes pangrams, which is a constraint that demands concision, especially true of the isopangram, whose stipulation is that each letter of the alphabet is used once and only once.
Okay.
Here is my best effort to be presented alongside an appropriate image, of course. Krith.jpg vex quiz my folk bands. That uses all the letters of the alphabet. Okay. He also does all letters of the alphabet, picking one letter to use 6 times.
Oh my gosh.
This is all the letters of the alphabet with A used 6 times. My jackdaw flaps, heaving a quartz box. Jeez. Then he has a pangram that uses each of the vowels twice, but every other letter exactly once. A quick brown fox jumps the glazed ivy.
Whoa.
Webs of mock plight quiz and vex a jury. Then he has anagrams. Anagram names, poisoned Poseidon, risen siren. Pithy prose anagrams can also be made from a pair of sentences or from a string of clauses. Here's an example of each. I consider among my best. Shot, assaulted seabird. The albatross is dead.
That's great.
Those are anagrams of one another. Shot, assaulted seabird. The albatross is dead.
Wow.
Here's another one of his. The rain, then air, are thin in earth.
Wow.
Yeah. He writes hard stuff. Here's another palindrome by letter. A zig, now one zag. I'm sorry, this is a palindrome by letter, which means it's the same forward and backwards. A zig, now one zag, gaze now on Giza.
Wow.
How fabulous is that? Here's another
one. This is a man who walks around and just goes, Giza. Giza's a great word.
Totally.
Here's another one. Another palindrome. Drowsy brawl, a York Royal, war by sword.
Wow.
And this is a whole book.
What's this guy's
book.
Draft journal like? What's it like, you know, like, yeah, what does he start
with? His notebook has got to make you nuts.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Like, incomplete palindromes must drive you crazy.
Yeah. He has the whole book of these, and they have weird drawings because he's going mad at the same time. It's really beautiful stuff. Here's one that's a palindrome. It's called Laments of a Carved Wooden Owl. Too honed, am I not? I sleep, I do. Owl, as a basil wood, I peel, sit on, I made no hoop. Hoot, made no hoot.
I made no hoot.
I made no hoot.
Did you behave yourself? I made no hoot.
Oh my goodness. I'm going through this book. It's mind-blowing. And he does this all the time. I believe he's a sound engineer, and this is his hobby. But I have all his books, and that's called Slate Petals by Anthony Etherin, Etherin. There is a friend of mine who I had at Clown College named Captain Rainbow, friend of mine at Clown College, who was obsessed with what constrained language did to your thinking and how it could restrain hard emotions. So when he was having a really tough time, he found that he went and wrote poetry. So then he changed to when he was really, really angry, he would only speak in rhyme.
Oh my gosh. That diffuses it a bunch, I bet.
Yeah. Or enrages everyone. How do you bam the heck out of someone who speaks in rhyme?
If he sets up the word stunt, you shut him up before he finishes.
Yes. Next, if he's speaking of the guy who created Candid Camera, Alec Funt, or if he's speaking one of the little people uncomfortably as a runt.
Do not let him finish his anger.
Do not let him finish his anger. But I got to tell you, when I was following the Stephen Fry poetry book, which, as you know, it took me 10 years to get through.
Yeah.
Writing that poetry, I found that constraining my thoughts helped me to think so much clearer. You know,
well, I know I enjoy it as a writer, a joke writer. If they say like you know you can't curse, we can't say this, you know, like you can't do pop culture, blah blah blah. Like when you box yourself in the corners, sometimes it's really fun to try to write jokes through that. You know.
Well, if you believe that art thrives on its limitations. Yeah. Anthony Etherin is your guy.
Exactly. Yeah.
He's inventing new limitations.
Oh, he does. He puts more.
That's
and more
fantastic.
On himself. He wrote two versions of To Be or Not to Be that were palindromic and anagrams of one another.
That's insane.
Yeah. And he's a really good guy. And I went out to supper with him because I liked his poetry. Incidentally, Christian Bach came to our show and gifted me Anthony Etherin's Moby Dick because, needless to say, they are friends.
Ah, yes.
How was he at ordering in a restaurant? That's a really interesting.
And like, does he have coworkers? Or when he's like, Giza, that's been out there for so long, I finally grabbed Giza.
Giza, like, oh. It's a zig. It's a zig. Giza, a zig.
Oh.
Yeah. I said, how do you do this stuff? I said, is there like a program? He said, it takes a long time.
If you had like a wife next to him, she would have just, her face would have been the one to look at.
You should have seen him dancing when he found Atlas.
he inspired me to write a couple of constrained things that used all the letters of the alphabet.
Oh.
It's really, really hard. I mean, really hard. Trying to find it now to see if I can if I can dig it up, some of the stuff that I wrote. They're really hard, by the way. You work on them a really, really, really long time.
I mean, just finding them seems really hard.
Yeah, finding them sometimes hard.
I can't imagine after writing them.
After you've written them, it's really hard. I cannot find my constrained poetry. So be thankful. God is kind. And that was Penn Sunday School. Cha, cha, cha. You become naked. I'm still looking. There's still a little bit of hope. I found it. I have found it. I believe I have it. Just go. I have to go down. Oh, I think it's down here. Here we go. Constricted poetry. This is written by Etherin for me. Anthony wrote this for me, okay? This is a palindrome by pairs, which means the two letters go together, but not single letters. This is Bob Dylan, a palindrome by pairs for pen by Anthony. Phrase by phrase met, I edit. I sever in alto any lead on desire. Wide on blonde wire, side one, Dylan to a line, revisited time, serif by serif.
Wow.
And then I have my point. This is a pentagram haiku written by me. Why must people judge your quixotic universe of broken waltzes?
Oh, nice.
And then this is my anagram haiku. The outbound sirens, eons hunted, orbit us, but there is no sound. Those same letters, doves cry on the fjord, my quixotic B-flat waltz, making your pangram. And it's very hard, this is my observation, pangrams are very tricky without the unjustified use of quixotic and B-flat waltz. Oh, I have a lot of advice. This is advice from Anthony. My best advice is to harness the power of prepositions, conjunctions, and other short words. As A is a palindrome that can be inserted to help clunky palindromes make better sense. For reflects nicely as are of, in, on, is, to, at, and, so, and or, which can be used with the form. And no are all useful too. Although we discussed last night, the is sadly of no use.
Yeah. Do we have anybody to thank?
We do. The following people will rise to vote, sir, and they go hang a salami, I'm a lasagna hog. Paul McBride, Scooped Mids, Jim the 20-Year Naked Magician, Steve Volcano, Julian Webb, Danny Olwine, Alexander Hoffman, Jesse Miller, Michael Kaplan, Kelly Reeves, Nate Soloway, Jeremiah Jenkins, Joseph Mastrangelo, Dr. Scoop Little, Michael Cohen, Kristen Kladick, Allison Sage, Winter Riakowski, Jeremy R. 2022, Ovi Dimitrian Jr., Robin Garnett, Jeremy Davidson, and Kelly McCauley.
Thank you. Thank you.